Hey everyone, this is the Renegade Animation co-host and editor of the podcast, Cameron, the animation guru from Renegade Pop Culture. The Screen Actors Guild strike might be over, but when the Animation Guild negotiates their contracts and or goes on strike alongside the VFX industry, because we know that's going to happen, make sure to show the same support you showed to WGA and SAG organizations. Because without the talented animators, artists, and visual effects folks help make the stories, shows, and films we love. And the people in charge need to stop doing stuff like shelving the Coyote versus Acme film and or canceling things in various forms of production. Because the executives thought infinite growth was a sustainable thing. We at Renegade Animation and Renegade Pop Culture will be here and stand with the animation guilds, the VFX industry, and anyone else who will be going on strike for better pay and working conditions. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. Also, make sure to share out our episode. Also, consider supporting our Patreon. That way, we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about animation. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to an episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And today's episode is a special one because we are talking about, I'm not going to bury the lead here, this is probably one of the best shows I've seen all year, animated or otherwise. We are talking about Blue Eye Samurai, created by Michael Green and his wife, Amber Noizumi. Cameron, would you like to describe the premise of Blue Eye Samurai?
It is set in Japan's Edo period, the 17th century. We follow a mixed-race blue-eyed samurai named Mizu, voiced by Maya Erskine, and on her quest for vengeance against the four white men that have caused her pain and misery. Let's get started with this. So this is an 8-episode season where each episode is about an hour's length, where they are pretty much mostly written by Michael Green and Amber Noizumi, with Noizumi writing the Tale of the Ronin and the Bride episode, which is episode 5, and Yana Billy Chung, who wrote Nothing Broken, which is episode 7. And this was one of the more hyped series that was coming out this year. I think there was a preview of it during Annecy and at Animation is Film back in near the end of October. Some lucky fans got to see the first episode on the big screen. If I wasn't already seeing another movie during that time, I would have absolutely loved to have seen it on the big screen. But I also had screeners for it beforehand. So this plays out, for the most part, like a fairly traditional samurai epic. We follow a mysterious swordsman who is on a journey for revenge to get back at some member of royalty or whoever that has wronged them in their life. Though, I mean, like, if you want to be pedantic, Mizu is more of a ronin than a samurai because she does not answer to a shogun or an emperor.
It took them a while for that to actually be acknowledged, but that's neither here nor there.
No, that's just a super nitpick. And then there's just like a lot of cultural context of what a samurai is and what a ronin is. So, and along the way, she encounters a couple different characters. We have Ringo, a sheltered, disabled cook who's voiced by Masioka, and encounters a prideful individual named Taigen, voiced by Darren Barnett, who Mizu beats in a sword fight, cuts off the man bun on his head, which in Ronin samurai culture is like part of your identity. And that's why he goes after Mizu, realizing that like a big driving force with a lot of the story is these characters finding what drives them and how the paths they are on may be the ones that they want to be on, but isn't the ones that they need to walk alongside.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the arcs is Mizu, she is the iconic, traditional, stone-cold swordsman. She's not very interactive or has like empathy or sympathy for anyone else but her. There are some points early on where she does like feel bad for someone, like the mother and child who are not able to pass through that one gate because they had a pass, but the pass had to be relegated to the husband who was no longer around. And along the way, she realizes how her actions is making her more and more isolated from the world around her. She pushes away people from like Ringo and Taigen, or the Princess Akemi, who's voiced by Brenda Song, thinking that like anyone that latches onto her in her life will just bring her down, drag her pace to a halt and what have you. And her arc starts with encountering and warming up to Ringo, who finds kinship with Mizu because of the cultural aspect of how Mizu is a mixed race individual. And it, when people see her blue eyes, they think she's a monster, a freak, a demon, an onryo. And Ringo is seen as an outcast himself because he was born without hands, but he still does not let that define him. He's handicapped, but that's not how he is defined. He's not defined by it.
These aren't the only two examples of great disabled representation, because one of the other characters we meet, the Sword Father, who is voiced by Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa, a blind blacksmith who raised Mizu and pretty much gave her the sword that she's used to take down pretty much everyone in this series.
Exactly. It's interesting how they make sure that these characters are not defined by how people see them. And it's really cool to see how all the characters change and either adapt or become more enraptured with their actions and goals in life. Where Ringo starts out wanting to be like a samurai, and then once at this small village festival, he learns that he wants seen as strong and powerful, but knows that the world will not see him as that. But he goes along through these 8 episodes becoming strong without having to go the route of what Mizu was going to until episode 6, when she gets basically a reset button and learns what she must do to encounter our villain, Abijah Fowler, who's voiced by Kenneth Branagh. It's just cool to see an adult animated series. And this is very much adult, not just because of the cursing or the violence. This show tackles extremely adult, complicated themes. And probably one of the few adult animated series I can think about that makes no real joke or gag out of how much nudity is in this show.
I think it was even Michael Green himself who described this as pretty much like an animated version of Game of Thrones, where And that's just something that I noticed about this show. It's like it's written like prestige TV, but they make the conscious choice to have this in animation just because this is the way to advance the medium. If we want animation to be taken seriously, it has to be open to any sort of storytelling.
I mean, that's what's been interesting about this year so far, just to segue into talking about the world of adult animation and to set up our future, the state of adult animation in 2023 episode in December. 2023 has been a very interesting year for adult animation. We've had such a variety of shows that progress or take a different direction of what we define in the US as adult animation. And some just stay in the same spot they've always been because that's how most adult animated shows are seen and are, the safe bets and what have you. Not to say that like no adult animated show this year has been like playing it by the numbers, but some have definitely gone above and beyond than other shows, and that's either because of time, talent, and trust from the production companies or distributors to let the artist cook. That's seen throughout this whole show with Blue Eye Samurai. Another good example is Taigen, who feels like he lost his honor, his pride, his manlyhood against Mizu. And throughout a majority of the first half of the show, chases after her to get revenge against her and face her in a duel to regain his honor, but then realizing that's not what he wants. He wants to be taken seriously, just kind of like Ringo, but he knows his current path was destructive, metaphorically and literally speaking. Same with Mizu. And it's just so fun to see an adult animated show take its levity and its world and writing and characters so seriously. I felt like they paced this out well because, as we know, a lot of streaming nonsense comes with making shows and movies for the streaming age, which is currently in a very volatile spot right now.
To put it
And
lightly.
they're thinking like, oh, we won't need to do 13 episodes. We'll just do it in 8. You wonder how much they are able to fit into those 8 episodes. I think it helps that each episode has a longer running time than most adult animated shows. I think most still stick with like 30 minutes. This is one of like a few handful of recent animated shows aimed more at adult audiences that are an hour long, with Pluto being the other one, which is also really good. We'll talk about that soon. But it's just cool to see a show like Blue Eye Samurai, even though it has like its mix of comedy, action, violence, sex, nudity, and drama, it felt well paced. It didn't feel like they had to rush certain parts of it. And no character felt underutilized. Like the secondary characters did what they needed to do. The main characters were all complex, very engaging.
That's what I was going to say, that there's a lot of nuance and complexity to these characters beyond just their one-track mind goals. Whether they know it or not, they open themselves up to the influence of those that they encounter. And there is no better example of that than how Mizu starts to where she ends up by the end. And while she is still pretty much dead set on getting her revenge, how she does it is, I guess, altered by her interactions with the rest of her supporting cast.
There's also like small little side stories that are going on. We've talked about Ringo and Taigen's, but Akemi and her relationship with Seki, her tutor, grandfather, kind of like guardian individual voiced by the always great George Takei. You see how Akimi is trying to find her way in life because her father thinks of her as a bartering tool for power. It's like, I'll just let you get married to a shogun's son because they have money and power, and that means I can have more money and power and have a child. And Akimi wants to find her own path, while Seki wants to help her and thinks he knows what she wants, but he was still thinking about what he thinks Akimi wants.
Yep.
Which is still not so different than what Akimi's dad was going to do.
It's like Seki had to learn the hard way that the only way he's ever going to give Akimi the life that she wants is if it is her choice. And even she has to learn through her own experiences how to get what she wants.
Exactly. And all this complexity that we see with our main characters spills into, for the most part, the villains of who we follow, with Abijah Fowler and probably my favorite character on the antagonist side, Heiji Shindo, who's voiced by the great Randall Park. Randall Park brings such a wormy sliminess, a tactical mind with Heiji Shindo as a character. You're not entirely sure if you can trust him, but it shows that his plans, or I guess his 4D chess plans, works both ways, because he was willing and ready to help Mizu get to Abijah Fowler. But when Mizu was like, nah, and Heiji was ready to kill her, he was still ready to use his connections and his power and influence against Fowler himself. And I think that's just such a great character to follow with Heiji.
Out of everyone in the cast, I think I was the most impressed by Randall Park. It's not because he gives the best performance, but he shows a particular range that I don't think I've seen from him before. When he shows up, it's either in a comedy or a comedic role in, say, the MCU. But here, obviously, he's giving a more
devious.
Yeah. He's playing against type as an antagonist, but it's not really a jokey performance. It is slimy, and he does have a dark sense of humor, but he's also just genuinely dangerous as an individual.
Well, it was funny because when Taigen and Mizu encounter Heiji, at first you are kind of wondering if Heiji is bluffing about the archers on the other side of the cliff. Because you think like, yeah, I think he does. And then it's like, oh no, he's just bluffing. He has no power out here. And then when the sky gets covered in arrows, it's like, oh no, he's got it. It's like he was telling the truth. Now with Fowler, like, we have some fairly one-dimensional villains in this show so far, like Hachi the slave seller, who's voiced by Wes Leong, and Chiaki, voiced by Mark Dacascos, who I thought he was great in this show. And if you haven't if you haven't seen him in the recent season of Warrior, he's great in that too. I do like how Chiaki is a character that comes back from Mizu's past, because he starts out as a samurai wanting the sword maker to make a weapon for him. He's basically told that you do not deserve this weapon. And then years later, we see him as one of the Four Fangs, a group of four mercenaries that are sent to kill Mizu. And you find out that, like, Chiaki is the leader of them, and he still kept that broken sword from those years ago. That whole fight sequence was great, by the way, against the cliff sides and such, where Mizu had her mobility limited by where she could jump down to without taking a larger fall.
Speaking of choreography, that's another beneficiary of the show being in animation. You can get more creative with like elaborate fight choreography that doesn't necessarily require endangering
anyone. We're at a point right now where live action, well, action is becoming more elaborate because of the people behind the camera who are very much from an action background, either as, you know, stunt men who worked on that stuff. With animation, the only thing stopping you with animation is a production timeline and budget, which I assume, because of the amazing CGI animation on display with this show, this had a pretty hefty coin pouch to spend with.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And the action is dynamite, with some of the, probably the best action that you'll see in animation, next to Scavenger's Reign and Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. It has a grounded feeling to it, so it's not just over-the-top anime stylized set pieces. Like episode, I think, 6. Yeah, All Evil Dreams and Angry Words. There's a sequence where Mizu has to jump over this spike pit and then uses her sword to make sure that she can get across properly. And then has to face down, what, like 10 or so or more?
Something like that.
Guards. And without having to use her sword, just brutally murderizes them. And it even has a slightly dark joke of how Mizu gets her sword back. It was very much like, that is messed up, but that's also fairly funny.
I also love the needle drop in that scene. It's like this, I guess, upbeat song, given the, like, the situation that she's in. It's very unintentionally hilarious.
And there's also another needle drop that I knew you would like, because in that same episode, you see Mizu save Taigen and encounter the big, bald warrior guy with the club again, and a cover version of a Metallica song kicks in. And this is kind of where some of the only anime influences come in, because it's like, she stabs that guy through the neck, and he's still like, nah, no, I'm filled with rage and vinegar, man. I am not going down until I say I go down.
I just want to say that episode 6 is probably my favorite episode. It's only a coincidence that it happens to be the shortest at only 35 minutes, but just everything about the imagery, the use of red, and everything about that fight scene at the end, where you get to hear the Japanese cover of For Whom the Bell Tolls. This is why animation was the right medium to tell this story.
Not that you couldn't do this in live action. I mean, come on, we have like John Wick and the Warrior show on HBO Max. But there are still limitations with live action that you don't have to deal with in animation.
Right. This could have been live action, but it was a conscious choice to make this animated.
And another aspect I want to talk about, just to get back to the villain talk with Fowler, I was very curious to know where exactly they were going to go with him. The two radical differences you have are the big brute who uses force to, like, you know, the might makes right kind of guy, or you have the tactician who is smart and has basically planned everything out 24 steps ahead of you, but cannot fight for himself. But Fowler is a mix of both. And it's interesting how everyone underestimates Fowler from like among the emperors and the people in power in Japan do, there's always a bit of unease of how they have to encounter and talk with Fowler, but they think they'll have the upper hand against him when Fowler has already thought of all the steps 3 days ahead of everyone else.
He's playing 4D chess while everyone else is playing checkers.
Exactly. The big reveal in episode 7 of how Heiji was trying to get the other people in power to get a hold of Fowler's weapons. And Fowler, he technically brought no weapons that you could see. And how he basically brought over all of this furniture, all these knickknacks and such, to put the gun together himself and for his army to take over Japan. It was such a delightfully sinister moment, especially when one of the people he shoots turns out to be one of the collaborators that Heiji was also working with.
Yep.
Do you think Fowler knew that Heiji was kind of working against him? Or do you think Fowler wasn't thinking, hey, maybe this guy is trying to work against me in some way, shape, or form?
I have to assume that if he didn't know, like, for sure, he at least had his suspicions. Because you can sense tension between Fowler and Heiji throughout all of their interactions. They don't necessarily enjoy each other's company. They're pretty much after the same thing.
It's a partnership that they are having to begrudgingly deal with. Even though I said like the secondary characters do what they needed to, I still liked some of them, even if we didn't get too much of some of them, like Takayoshi, the shogun's son, who's voiced by Harry Shum Jr., who more people would know Harry from the Legion of Superheroes movie where he plays Brainiac 5. And I like that they build up Takayoshi as this sinister, evil, just violent individual. But he's instead a very soft-spoken man who is very humble and just wants to do right by his father, but also his new wife, who is Akemi and such, by the end of it. Well, new wife for like a day. But I also liked Madame KG, who's voiced by Ming-Na Wen, who runs the brothel. And I liked how this show tackled sex. It showed the range of sex, of how it could be exotic, it could be interesting, it can be arousing, and it could also be scary, rough, but also just, it's a thing we all do, because there is a, what was it, a survey recently that went out about asking like a bunch of random people or different age groups what they think about sex and media and what have you. And even though that survey still asked a bunch of people under the age of 18 for some reason.
Yeah.
Like, parts of that survey are more interesting than its sum. Just because it's just like, people just don't want sex to be like, oh, now they're going out and such, or in a relationship. I understand that. Like, more friendships and more platonic relationships are cool. Nothing wrong with that. But to say there's no purpose to it, and there's no point, there's a razor's edge of when something is intentionally titillating and like has a purpose to the story, or no purpose, but is just, you know, part of the world that we live in, or it's very exploitive and doesn't actually offer anything. Like how some movies will be like, oh yes, this person's evil because he has so many women that are at his beck and call. And it's just like shallow. Like, sexuality in media has layers to it.
Yeah, and I would
And
say in the case of this show, A, it's very sex positive, and B, how it's portrayed and how Madame Kaji, how she uses sex, and she uses it very strategically, if that makes any sense.
how it's portrayed in a show runs the gambit. And I think that's fun. And I mean, like, it never felt like it was exploitive in the wrong way. And like, and that's just another thing with why this adult show is great. It's equal opportunity for nudity. Like,
Yep.
you see both men and women naked. And that's so rare because I remember back in 2010 when, like, the stuff like HBO was going through its second wind and the likes of Netflix popped up. There was always that sense of a very short form solution of what can we show or do that the cable providers at the time would not let us do. And a lot of that was sex and nudity. Mostly female nudity, but nudity nonetheless. Luckily, as time has moved forward and you get past that, like, first episode, like, grab the male audience, like, episode, like, shows have gotten better at using it, especially here, and how KG and the other women that work at the brothel are all people. They're not objects. And like, they even go through just like a few quote unquote taboo kinks and situations within the fourth episode. And it's a good example of how there was a reason for it to be here, because a lot of the sex work roles and jobs that are portrayed in this show were like had to do with Akemi because of like how Seki or Akemi's father were like, hey, you either lay with a man that I choose for you or you lay with a man at a brothel. Your choice. Taking out her agency and then her finding her own agency in that same episode. Like I said, it's just cool with how this show handles all of these topics. And I think my favorite episode is episode 5 from a story perspective, where we, because at first, with how it's framed, it's like a story, a literal stage play. And it shows Mizu early on in her journey and finding out that her mom was alive. And then her mom basically, what's that thing where it's just like a contractual marriage or what have you?
An arranged marriage.
An arranged marriage, sorry, with an ex-samurai. And the, okay, maybe this is the life you should actually want. And what wrecks it is the fact that no matter how far away she got from her old ambitions, she couldn't truly escape them. And by the end of it, both the ex-samurai and her mom are killed, and she finds herself back on the path of vengeance.
That weapon is awesome. I think whether or not the story in the stage play happened, I think it was just a really cool creative choice to run that and like the narration parallel to this flashback of Mizu and this short-lived but at times pretty sweet arranged marriage that she has.
It was very touching and like a glimpse of what could have been, and sadly was not going to be. It's another example of how her vengeance and her what drives her got in the way of what could have been a perfectly normal life.
No matter how hard she tried to run from her past, it's always going to catch up with her.
On an animation level, this is a gorgeous looking show. The production companies behind this are listed as Blue Spirit, GA Green Construction Corporation, and 3 Arts Entertainment. And the CGI here is lovely. It has a painted, like, Japanese ink style look to all the characters. Not entirely Hokusai style, but if you're looking for more examples of stylized CGI animation that's not just in theaters, this is definitely the one to look for in terms of that craving that you have. Everything is just drop dead amazing to look at. The cinematography paints beautiful scenes. It's almost another one of those examples of every frame's a painting, literally. It was tough to like find images to show people with this show because I was just like, I have so many that I want to share and show because it's like, this is really cool. This sunset duel between Mizu and against the ocean, or the reveal of the what could have been with Mizu and the ex-samurai, or any of the nighttime sequences, or the snow-covered areas, or just even like the background civilians and such, like any of the festival sequences or the death duel that happens in episode 4.
Oh yeah, as you put it, you could take any frame from the series and just like hang that on your walls as a poster. This show just has like just gorgeous imagery all around. Episode 5 is the only one that Michael Green directed himself, and his wife wrote the script. It's that plus episode 6, I think, are tied for my favorites.
I also like another little story detail I like is how Ringo never thinks of anything about Mizu's gender. Like, I think that like gender plays a very big part in the overarching story of some of the characters. Like, Taigen never finds out that Mizu is a woman. But I think either way, Taigen would probably react the same way with Ringo, who respects them because of their person, not because of their gender. Where obviously some people and characters in this show look down on others because of, like, Akimi or Mizu being a woman and such.
Yeah. I also think it's just really progressive how, as you said, like, it's never come into question whether or not she is like male or female. Pretty much all they know is that she is mixed race, therefore she is ugly, impure, a demon.
But she proves them wrong because it's like, it doesn't matter what I am if my sword kills you, buddy. So
exactly.
And there's also that great claustrophobic fight sequence against the 1,000 knives or the 100 knives. The soldiers that infiltrate Madame Kaji's brothel. Like the soldiers with the claws and such. It like, you feel the struggle. Like Mizu is not just a super no one can kill me samurai. She is vulnerable. She is weak at points. She does make mistakes, but she is still like someone you don't want to mess with. That samurai at the end of that one fight sequence, like where they had to get their, like her sword back from over the spike pit and such, and how that one guy was left alive. He should consider himself lucky because of it.
Jump off a point you made about her being vulnerable. She's not just like invincible, but at the same time, I think it's in episode 8 where Master Eiji says her soul is too stubborn to die.
So before we jump into like the ending of this show and such, the voice cast for this was amazing. I thought they did a very good job with their roles. Maya Erskine, she doesn't have too many voiceover roles in animation, but you would have seen her as Mercy Graves in DC League of Super Pets or Scoob. And she's apparently going to have a role in the upcoming Wildwood, the new Laika animated film,
which I'm very excited for.
And of course, we talked about Jor Sakei and Masioka, Kiri Hiroyuki Tagawa. You would have seen him in a few different things. Like, he was Shang Tsung in Mortal Kombat 11, showed up in Star Wars Visions back in 2021, and also in Kubo and the Two Strings, one of the townsfolk. Brenda Song, I mean, a lot of Disney fans would know her as Anne from Amphibia.
Yep.
And Vanessa View as from The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder. Darren Barnett, we saw him recently as Mike from Skull Island. He is also Yuichi Usagi from Samurai Rabbit, The Usagi Chronicles.
That's right.
And played one of the major characters from Summon of the Gods, the great mountain climbing film from 2021. And we Stephanie Hsu from, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once, who was also in this year's The Monkey King. And it's also going to show up in Leo. I don't know who in Leo, but we'll have to see how that movie goes. We also have Ming-Na Wen, who we all know as Mulan.
Yep.
And she was also in... she's having a killer year for voice work. She was also in Gremlins Secret of the Mogwai as the main character's mom. Like, Kenneth Branagh was very good. I thought he had a level of hamminess and a sinister tone that wasn't too over the top. He leveled it in just right.
Honestly thought when I first heard him that that was Brendan Gleeson. He does a really good job. I bet one of the reasons why he was cast is because he and Green worked on those Agatha Christie adaptations. They have a connection.
We talked about everyone else. Harry Shum Jr., Mark Dacascos, Wes Leong. Gede Watanabe plays a sentry character. Brittany Ishibashi, one of the Shindo samurai, is voiced by Eric Bauza. We also have Marcus Choi and Matthew Yang King, Holly Cho, Patrick Gallagher, Takaki Hirakawa, and Keon Young, who pops in our voice cast from time to time, who plays the Shindo dojo master. Like, great cast.
This cast is just incredible. It's a nice range of a couple voice actor veterans, but also just people who fit these characters like a glove.
As we mentioned earlier, Pluto was also another adult animated series that was like hour-long episodes with an also killer cast. Like, oh my gosh. Like, once you see the voice cast for this show, for Pluto, you will be like, oh, I definitely, like, you'll love it. So, as for the music, which was also very good, Amy Doherty was behind the composition. And it captures the samurai atmosphere that you want and, like, the different locations in Japan that we encounter and such. It all blended very well into the visuals and storytelling. There never was like a weird out of place tune that I can think of. Like, it's tough. I think this might be my favorite show of the year, tied with Scavenger's Reign and Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. It's just so different. That's a big thing about this year in animation. So many shows are distinct. There's no like, this is just a mediocre version of this show or whatever.
I have to agree with that. This has been the year. I know last year we got a little bit negative when we were talking about how, especially at Netflix, we were hearing about so many shows that were being canceled or stuck in development hell. But this year, we're seeing a lot of, as you put it, variety in what the medium has to offer, and that just makes me incredibly happy that, like, no matter what's going on in the business, eventually great storytelling will find its audience.
Exactly. And I highly recommend this show. Like, it seems this isn't the last time we will be in here, because with the ending where essentially most of the characters find their satisfying arc, but we do get a tease for maybe one more season or part, however they want to describe it, with Mizu going to London with Fowler to find the people that have wronged Mizu. And I don't know if we'll see half of these characters again, because I don't know where Tigen could go or Ringo. But do you think we'll see them again? Or do you think we'll find a new batch of characters for Mizu to encounter outside of Fowler and maybe Ringo?
If we see them again, they probably will have just their own side stories to explore for an episode or two, but they won't have as much presence as they will in this season, because I feel like we're going to get introduced to a whole new set of supporting players if, like, London is our main destination.
Because the whole final episode takes place during the infamous Great Fire of Meireki, which I told Mike this off camera. It's like the fire lasted for 3 days and killed essentially 100,000 people. And by the end of it, Fowler is just like, if you kill me, you will not find the people who wronged you. And I have one word that will make you change your mind. And that was London. And we end with a ship going to London. So it'll be interesting to see if we do get one more part or what have you, because it seems like the popular thing to do is either do a one-off limited series or 2 to 3 seasons tops because of crummy executive negotiations and such.
I really do want to see more of the story because, well, A, I just think this show is amazing, but I'm just genuinely curious to see how Mizu is going to survive in a new environment and how her actions are going to influence the lives of people she comes across.
I mean, and that's really all I have to say. I can't wait to see part 2 or what season 2 or what have you. If you really want to see animation change and you want to support more original ideas and shows that help expand the world of animation, then you need to watch this show and talk about it. Like, discuss it on Twitter or Blue Sky or whatever social media service or site you use, because this is truly one of those special shows that everyone needs to see. Well, age-appropriate viewers need to see.
Yeah, but, you know, assuming you are the proper demographic, watch this show, tell your friends, tell anyone who theoretically would be into an animated series that takes itself seriously, but also has great action, gorgeous imagery, incredible music. And if you're a Metallica fan, their cover of For Who the Bell Tolls is awesome. But yeah, I can say with certainty that this is probably my favorite series of the year, animated or otherwise.
And it's also interesting because right when this show dropped on Netflix, FX and Hulu announced a adaptation of the 1975 novel Shogun, like a live action show and such. And it's just interesting because it's just like this show drops and then it's like FX and Hulu are like, hey, we got a show coming out next year that's about samurai that you may be interested in. And about Japan's culture and history and all that stuff. Yeah, otherwise that's really it. Our next episodes, we're going to take a week off and to watch all 35 shows in the fall anime season. Jiminy crickets, man.
I know. This might be
the most stuffed season ever. Like, golly.
I'm genuinely excited for it because the more shows we have to watch, the more opportunities each show has to make a good first impression. Whether or not that's true, we will let you know when the episode arrives. But until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, and as long as that site is still running, or Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I also have a website called camseyeview.biz where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have an Instagram, which is also camseyeview.biz, and a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser, subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/renegadepopculture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.